Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Larkin, Judge Flory, the Honorable Renee Werke presiding.
Good morning to counsel that is appearing by ITV. You can see us and we will see you when you begin speaking. Just so you know, Judge Larkin is in fact absent today. If you see the chair that's turned around, we're not trying to have a game show. That's just exactly what's going on. She's got the flu that has a lot of people out of their places of employment. She will, however, confer with this panel and is obviously familiar with the files and the proceedings and will listen to the oral argument. The tape of the argument. In addition, this does not affect the time frame in any way in terms of the case submission. So I'm going to have our clerk call the first case for consideration.
The next case is number A190353, Thomas W. Krabenhoff, petitioner, respondent, versus Norma A. Krabenhoff, now known as Norma A. Flores, appellant.
Counsel, each of you, of course, has 15 minutes for presentation of your case in chief, and 5 minutes is reserved to appellant counsel for rebuttal if you choose to use that. Please identify yourself and indicate which party you're speaking on behalf of before you begin your oral argument. You can proceed whenever you're ready to go.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm here this morning to ask that the trial court's order and judgment of August 16th be overturned. My name is Heidi Uecker, U-E-C-K-E-R. I represent Norma Krabenhoff, the appellant in this case. Respondent asserts that Rule 6001 and 375 apply here. However, it's my opinion that neither of those laws apply because this was not a clerical error. Instead, the proper statute that this motion should have been brought under was either 6002 or 518.145. Both of those statutes require that the motion to amend be brought within 1 year of the final order. It was 3 years and 5 months before this motion to amend was brought before the district court. The case on point here is the Johnson case, which basically set out the way to determine whether or not something is a clerical error or a mistake. And basically, it says that clerical errors arise from oversight or omission, and it can only be used to make the judgment or record speak to the truth. And it cannot make it say something other than was originally pronounced. The Johnson Court also pointed out in that case that the clerical error thwarted the intent of the parties. In the present case, the child support amount in the child support worksheet was agreed to by settlement.
If I recall, you weren't the attorney of record as far as the initial stipulation and dissolution of judgment.
You are correct, Your Honor. Both parties were represented by experienced and well-qualified attorneys at that time. And so the intention of both parties and both counsel was that the respondent pay $307 in the derivative benefit, and it was the petitioner's intention that she receive that money. And so there was no clerical error here, and in order to make this a clerical error, it cannot actually change what the parties agreed to. And so my assertion is that 6001 does not apply to this case because it's not a clerical error. Even if you found that 6001 applied, the court did not correct a clerical error in this case. The district court basically just ordered that the petitioner repay $11,666 to the respondent. They corrected nothing from the dissolution decree.
In fact, did the district court deny the motion to amend the judgment and decree?
You know, I would have to look back at that, Your Honor. I don't know that question.
Don't waste your time on it. I've got the order right in front of me here, and I just wanted to make sure that that was my correct reading of it. But it says petitioner's motion to amend is denied on August 15th of 2018.
So the court then did deny the motion to amend, and instead, what it ordered, without any statutory power to do so, it ordered that the petitioner repay to the respondent the 11,000 sum in child support. The error that played out here today cannot be a mistake. It has to be an error that had to be addressed, or a mistaken error that had to be addressed within 1 year of that final judgment, not 3.5 years later. In addition, 518.145 was created especially for marriage dissolution actions. And in fact, that's the real appropriate statute this case should have been brought under. That also talks about mistake and relieving someone from the order or judgment. Again, though, that has the 1 year timeline for filing. So it's my position that it was just too late for anything to be done about the child support mistake in the original judgment decree. Lastly, by the time we reached the court on the issue of the motion to amend and the repayment of the child support, the child support magistrate had already corrected the mistake and had lowered the respondent's amount of child support to zero. And lastly, they indicated that they don't have any way to recoup that amount from the petitioner, Norma. My second argument is that the respondent did not plead and the district court did not require him to prove he had grounds to reopen or amend the judgment under 518.145 sub 2. The respondent bore the burden of proof, and they have to prove at least one of the statutory grounds for reopening by a preponderance of the evidence. The court never even addressed this. There was some conversation by counsel about addressing that issue. It's mentioned in the briefs, but the district court didn't actually make a ruling on that at all. The case here is Halfley. The court noticed that, or they ruled that for the purposes of reopening a dissolution of judgment under 518.145, that they had to prove a statutory ground, and mistake is one of those. But again, it had to be made, the motion had to be made within 1 year. The Shirk court also held that the sole relief from a dissolution judgment decree lies in meeting the requirements of 518.145 sub 2. When a judgment decree is entered based upon a stipulation, the stipulation is merged into the judgment decree, and the stipulation cannot therefore be the target of attack by the party seeking relief from the judgment decree. The Knapp court also held that the moving party must prove one of the statutory grounds for vacating by a preponderance of the evidence. The Shirk court, quoting the Rogalla case, described extremely well here what happens when what happened in this case happens. When no fraud or bad faith is shown, if we were allowed the settlement made in open court to be reopened many months later at the whim of either party, it would create uncertainty, chaos, and confusion as to the effect of settlements in future cases. This would be an injustice both to the courts in which settlements were made and to the litigants involved who depend on the reliability of such settlements. So because of this court order of August 16th, the petitioner has unforeseen marital debt that she was not aware of at the time of negotiations. She made settlement decisions based on the child support mistake, and she gave up assets and other rights and maintains now that the marital termination is unfair. However, she's unable to reopen the divorce and renegotiate the settlement. This is the chaos that the Rogalla court cautioned against. At the very least, the district court must make findings on how the respondent met the statutory grounds for relief under his motion. But as I said, there's nothing in the record whatsoever on the district court addressing that issue. By waiting 3 years and 5 months after the entry of judgment and decree to file his motion and ask for relief, the respondent waived his right to get relief due to the mistake in the child support numbers. The Bowerly case is one of the most cited cases in our briefs, Your Honor. And the one thing that I want to point out here is that it was not 3 years after the final order before the Bowerly court changed the child support. The father, or the obligor, immediately filed motions to correct the errors. here again over 3 years have passed. Minnesota Statute 518.52 is relied upon by the respondent to boost his argument. However, a closer look shows that that this can be done in two ways, neither of which is entering a judgment against the obligee for overpaid child support. So 518.52 indicates that when there's an overpayment, I believe that one thing is that it can be applied to arrearages, and the second instance is that it can be repaid by taking 20% out of each future child support payment. The district court didn't follow that rule at all. Instead, they just said, Norma, you repay $11,666. The respondent is trying to argue that because the district court can correct a clerical error, that it was proper for the district court to determine there was an overpayment of child support and render a money judgment against the petitioner. None of these cases and statutes cited by the respondent allow a money judgment to be ordered due to the mistake without further findings, showing that the district court weighed the equities of the case and the parties and the best interests of the children. And so now probably the most interesting argument is the equitable power of the district court to do what it did. Only if the court determines here that the respondent, one, had grounds to amend or reopen the judgment and decree, and two, he made his motion timely, and three, that this court can retroactively modify child support, can the district court exercise its equitable powers. The respondent sort of indicates that the equitable powers of the district court are just all-knowing and all-doing, but they're not. Bowerly says that they do have the inherent power to grant equitable relief, but they must make findings justifying the exercise of its equitable powers. Again, the district court orders are devoid of any findings or facts that would indicate that they weighed the equities of the case. Because had they done that, it's likely the district court would have entered a judgment, would not have entered a judgment against the petitioner. And I think in my brief I outlined what those equities were, so I won't go over them again here. The Minnesota Supreme Court has carefully examined the entire chapter of 518 with a similar set of facts since Bowerly even. In Reed, Dakota County, it's similar to this case. The obligor sought credit from the child support magistrate for the derivative benefits already received by the obligee. The Supreme Court phrased the issue as whether an obligor is entitled to credit for derivative Social Security benefits received by an obligee on behalf of the minor children before they serve notice of motion and motion to modify. Because that's what the district court did here. They didn't just go back to the date of the motion to amend, which they denied. They went back from the date of the entry of the divorce. The Supreme Court said that no, credit for derivative benefits is only one piece of the statutory scheme. In order to give credit, the court must first determine the child support obligation by including the derivative benefit in the obligor's income and fully recalculating the child support obligation pursuant to 518.8.34. Granting the relief the respondent requested constitutes a retroactive modification of child support contrary to Minnesota Statute 518.8.39, which clearly and unambiguously states that the court's discretion is limited to retroactively modifying the child support to the date of service of respondent's motion to modify. Recalculating the obligation would require retroactively modifying it, which is clearly prohibited by statute. In order to determine whether the petitioner has really overpaid, and if so, by how much, this court would have to recalculate what respondent's obligation should have been with the derivative benefits, including his income. This court would have had to go back, or the district court would have had to go back and change it every time the petitioner or the respondent got a raise or an increase in benefits. The district court would have to recalculate the child support when one of the children aged out of child support. So by granting, basically, by failing to require the responded to prove a basis for reopening the divorce, allowing his motion to proceed more than 3 years after the final order. The district court didn't follow the law when ruling to amend the divorce decree. Therefore, it could not use equity as a basis for ruling in respondent's favor. The district court can't just say this is equitable and this is what I feel like doing. You know, I know this case is a 3.5 year overpayment. What is the court going to do when it sees a 20-year overpayment? And I think that's really the chaos that Rogala talks about. That's why we have 518.145 and 6002 that limits those motions to a one-year time limit after judgment is entered. That's all I have at this time.
Thank you. We'll turn to respondent counsel, who I understand is also at Clay County.
My name is Robert Schultz. Our law firm represents Tom Krabbenhoff regarding this matter. This is one of those somewhat unique cases in which the majority of the facts are undisputed. The party's dissolution occurred on November 5, 2014. They had three children, one of which was an adult at the time of the dissolution. Two were minors. The parties shared parenting time equally on a 50-50 basis. And my client, Tom, is a disabled veteran. He has no earned income at all. All of his income is from disability payments that he receives from Social Security or from the government.
What do these facts have to do with the issues before the court, Mr. Schultz?
Hearing some of the factual background.
Well, we've got your briefs. I'm familiar with what you're telling me, but I'm wondering how that affects what the district court did here.
Okay. Well, first of all, one of the arguments made by counsel was that equity demands that this overpayment not be repaid. And the district court concluded to the contrary. The district court concluded that equity required that this overpayment be paid back.
Well, the district court found that there was unjust enrichment, which all of our appellate authority requires a showing of illegal or immoral conduct of some sort. What type of illegal or immoral conduct did the appellant engage in here that resulted in this overpayment?
Mistake made by her lawyer. Her lawyer drafted the document which was relied upon for the child support calculation, and it's got a mistake.
Well, didn't his lawyer also approve that?
Pardon me?
Didn't his lawyer also approve the drafted marital termination agreement?
Yes.
So I'm having a hard time understanding how this is a clerical error as opposed to a legal error by the lawyers in this case.
Well, if you look at Exhibit 2, which is in the appendix, that's the worksheet that the child support document, child support obligation was based upon.
Right, I have it here in front of me.
Yeah, they just put the derivative payment in the wrong column.
Isn't that a legal judgment and not a clerical mistake?
There's no judgment at all. They just put it in the wrong column. It's a clerical error. It's not a legal, there's not like a debate as to where you put it. They just put it in the wrong column.
The lawyers, based upon their representation of their clients, put the figure in the wrong column. That doesn't strike me as a clerical error. How is that a clerical error?
I think this is the most basic clerical error you could ever have. They put the number in the wrong column. This isn't a question of should it have been $400 or $500, or there was no debate. They all knew what the number was. They just put it in the wrong column. That, by definition, is what a clerical error is.
Isn't that more a definition of a mistaken legal judgment?
Well, it's a mistake. there's no judgment. The rules are clear. The rules say you put the derivative payment in the column for the person that it came from, and then you also put it in the bottom.
But lawyers can make mistakes and have to deal with those out into the future. I don't know that a mistake by the lawyers in where they place those Social Security derivative benefits is necessarily a clerical error. That seems to be the premise of the argument, but I'm having trouble with accepting that this was a clerical error as opposed to an error in legal judgment of the lawyers.
Well, again, Your Honor, with all due respect, I disagree. I think this is one of the most obvious clerical errors I've ever seen. If this is not a clerical error, I don't know what is a clerical error. You put a figure in the wrong column. It isn't, again, something they debated. It's they just made a mistake, and my client has suffered as a result of that. He's overpaid his support, and that's why we're here.
Maybe he has a claim against his lawyer for not catching the error.
Well, that may be the fact, but he also has a claim against his spouse for overpayment of child support, and the district court agreed with that and requested and required her to reimburse him the overpayment that he made.
Do you agree, Mr. Schultz, that if this court were to determine that this was not a clerical error, that the matter needs to be evaluated then under 518.145?
Well, we had suggested there are three statutory or three bases for bringing this back in. And as far as it would be 518A, 52, 6001, as well as 375.01.
But both of the latter, 6001 and 375.01, both deal with clerical errors. So I guess my question is, if this court were to find it's not a clerical error, and I don't know if that'll be the determination, what is the proper statutory structure then for evaluating the matter?
Then it would be 518A52. And under that statute, it indicates that if there is an error, clerical or otherwise, it can be corrected. And the district court concluded that Norma was unjustly enriched and that correcting an error in child support calculation that unjustly enriched one party is not a retroactive modification, and determined that equity and justice required that Tom, a disabled veteran, be reimbursed for the overpayment of child support that he made. And it's hard to argue that's not the right answer, and it's hard to argue that's not the fair answer under the law. One of the cases that we cited was Johnson, and in the Johnson case, the court talked about what a clerical error is, and the court said clerical errors include drafting errors made by the parties. And that's exactly what this is. It's a drafting error made by the parties.
I don't know if I'd call it a drafting error. Wouldn't it be, I mean, it's a worksheet. So, you know, this was a tool to come up with the child support amount.
But if we look at what happened in Johnson, I think it's almost identical to what happened here. In Johnson, they transposed the word respondent and petitioner, and they said that the paying party's spousal support obligation would terminate upon his death or remarriage, and they really meant that it should terminate upon the recipient's death or remarriage. The guy remarried, and he said, great, I don't have to pay spousal support anymore. And the court said, no, that wasn't the intent of the parties. It was a clerical error, and they corrected it. That's what happened here. It just got put in the wrong column. It's a clerical error, and it was corrected. And whether it was a mutual mistake or a unilateral mistake It was a mistake that was made, and the district court did the right thing and corrected it. There was a question about what was the intent of the parties. The intent of the parties in this case was that they would apply income to the child support guidelines. And they attempted to do that, and they made a mistake. And it was a clear mistake. There was no debt on the date of divorce. It wasn't like some additional debt could be factored in the division of assets and liabilities. There was no overpayment at the time of divorce. The overpayment occurred after the divorce. And then there was an argument made that because there was no arrears and because there's no ongoing obligation, that an overpayment cannot be collected or remedied. And if you think about it, that really would create a rather perverse impact. And what that would do is it would penalize people like my client who are current in their child support obligation. In other words, the argument is if he was behind and owed a bunch of money, it could be offset against the arrearage. He has no arrears. Well, then it could be offset against his ongoing obligation. He has no ongoing obligation. So the only remedy was what the district court did, which was to award a money judgment in my client's favor.
So let me ask you this, so just so I understand the district court's order here, Mr. Schultz. The district court denied your motion to amend. So as the judgment and decree reads today, there's a $307 child support obligation. The child support magistrate reduced that to zero, but prospectively only. So without modifying the judgment and decree, how does the district court arrive at an overpayment?
Some of these technicalities, but the district court, you're correct, the district court denied our motion to amend, but concluded that equity required that my client be reimbursed for the overpayment and entered a money judgment against her in my client's favor for the amount of the arrearage. It maybe would have been cleaner if she would have granted the motion to modify and zeroed out the child support obligation from the beginning, but the result would be the same. And so I think it might be form over substance. What the district court was trying to do is do the right thing, which would be to refund to my client the overpayment of child support that he made all these years. That was brought up is the timeliness of the motion, and there were arguments that it was 3.5 years or 3 years and 4 months after the divorce. And what I think has to be remembered is how did my client become aware that there even was a problem or a mistake? It was when the second child graduated from high school that he went in and requested that his child support obligation be adjusted. And at that time, the magistrate looked at it and agreed, and then found the clerical error and corrected it. But that took several months to accomplish. And when the magistrate zeroed out his child support obligation, he did it effective as of December of 17. And then my client brought the motion that we're here on in April of 18. As far as the equity piece is concerned, there was some indication of their respective incomes. And my client's income, he receives VA disability of service disability annuity of $475 a month, and currently Norma is receiving half of that. And he also receives combat-related special compensation of $1,081 per month. All of his income is disability-related. He has no earned income. Norma, on the other hand, is healthy. She's employed on a full-time basis. Through employment, she makes $2,500 a month. She's also receiving the Social Security payment, which is $796 per month, and she's receiving half of his civil service disability annuity. My time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll turn back to appellant counsel for rebuttal if you choose to use the time.
Yes, just briefly, Your Honors. I do want to point out that my recollection is different than Mr. Schultz's. At no time was the error ascribed to Norma's attorney. I co-counseled with Norma's attorney during some of the district court proceedings, and she informed the court that she doesn't remember who drafted the child support worksheet or the MTA. So I just wanted to point that out. I also sort of wanted to remunerate what the definition of a clerical error is versus a mistake. The Johnson Court made it clear that a clerical error is an error that, when changed, does not make the order say something other than was originally pronounced. Again, what was originally pronounced was what the parties agreed to, what the attorneys reviewed, and what they all planned on getting and receiving. So it's not a clerical error. And that it therefore must be held to the one-year timeline for appeal. Mr. Schultz also argued that because under 518A.52, there was no remedy for his client for the overpayment because he wasn't in arrears and he had no ongoing child support, that it's okay just to say, heck with it. Let's just give a judgment for $11,000 to Mr. Kavanaugh. I think that his comparison of their incomes makes it really clear, as well as my brief, how the equities do not weigh in favor of the respondent in this case. And again, I won't go through them all, but regardless of where Mr. Kravenhoff gets his income from, his income is nearly three times the amount of Ms. Kravenhoff's. The child that's left with Ms. Kravenhoff spends 50 or more percent of his time in her home. And so by letting this judgment be placed against Ms. Kravenhoff and the fact that she, her wages could now possibly be garnished, is not in the best interest of that minor child. The petitioner may not be able to get a car loan, may not be able to refinance her home. This is a judgment against her credit that anyone is going to see. It's not in the best interest of the child, nor equitable, to have a judgment against the petitioner. The last point I wanted to make goes along with it being the clerical error, and that is that in the Johnson case that's being relied on by the respondent, the record was clear that when the respondent petitioner titles were mixed up, that it thwarted the intent of the parties based on all the other information in the record. And so everybody agreed that that was a mistake. It didn't affect anybody's order or anybody's life should they be changed. What it did is it changed it to reflect their true intention. And so today I'm asking the court to find that the district court abused its discretion and made errors of law and overturn the August 16th, 2018 order.
Thank you. That does conclude our first ITV hearing. Thank you to the attorneys for appearing and participating with the appellate matters in this fashion. A decision will be issued within the statutory time frame.